I'm Grant.
And this is Whiskers.
We share knowledge regarding Sequest.
Yeah.
So it keeps coming up in these episodes.
Uh-huh.
The show that this is most in conversation with, is, at least as far as perception, is Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yeah. Yeah.
As much as the creators want to talk about the Undersea Voyage and 2000 Leagues and Jacques Cousteau for like the actual ocean.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about Sequest, when you hear about Sequest, you think Picard, engage, right?
I mean, I don't think that, but I guess that's what people think. I do explain it as like sci-fi, but in the ocean instead of space.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I guess Star Trek's the most close to it because of the type of like structure, cultural structure that they're at that point.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly what I was thinking. So this led me to think about what is it that makes a Star Trek as opposed to any of the other kinds of stories. Right. Yeah. You've got a team of professionals in an organization applying collaborative problem solving to impossible situations. That is what a Star Trek is.
It's their job.
Right, right. You see it in Ultraman. You see it in lots of things. He's International Rescue from the Thunderbirds. These are all Star Treks.
Okay.
But Sequest often drops the impossible bit.
Yeah.
Like, okay. We just had an episode about rescuing one very stubborn teen.
Oh, that definitely happened in, like, Star Trek.
But like,
half the time it was Wesley.
We've had an episode about a dolphin getting sick and people being sad about it, or like a get rich quick scheme got really out of hand. These are not impossible problems. These are small scale problems compared to yet another godlike entity.
Yeah.
Or an earthquake that sinks Boston into the sea.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that is something that really sets Sequest apart from its peers, from its fellow travelers in this sort of lane of television.
We do, though, get a lot of the, like, godlike crazy shit.
We don't have to talk about season two until we get there.
Just saying.
But this is another episode that I guess straddles the line. Like, the immediate stakes are very small, are ship or smaller scale. But there is a possibility.
Possibly everyone dies in the world.
Possibly.
Yeah. It's kind of big. It's kind of big. A big thing.
But this is episode 7 of the first season called Give Me Liberté.
Yeah.
This is written by John J. Sackmar and Carrie Leonard. This is the team that brought us Treasures of the Tonga Trench.
Mm-hmm.
And directed by Bill L. Norton, who directed the immediate preceding episode, Brothers and Sisters.
Y'all, there's just like a good sequence going here in the season right now where it's like boom, 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 good episodes.
I would call this...
And this is like the weakest of them?
Yes,
This is the weakest of this series, but compared to like the last episode on this disc that we're eventually going to have to watch, this is still good compared to that shit.
There is something I realized about this episode about halfway through.
It's not as... Brothers and Sisters is a better episode.
Yes,
you were
is.
Originally thinking this one's better, and I'm like, no.
This one has a great concept and a really fantastic guest star.
Mm-hmm.
That does not make it a terribly top-tier episode.
No. But compared to some... It's middle ground.
Yes.
And it's definitely like bumps up against some. The next ones that are coming though. Oh man. They're so good. This episode, we are in a fracture zone.
Would you consider that some sort of trench?
A trench.
It's a trench. It's always
just
a
different name for a trench. And we got a sea launch that is docking with a Ford on board.
A Ford on board.
The Ford on board.
Is it one of them hybrids I keep hearing about? Great mileage with that Ford on board.
Yeah.
Yes. Commander Ford is running this operation to resupply and give some relief to a bunch of nerdos on Aquasphere 7.
Bunch of scientists. Yeah, so he's bringing the relief crew, and he's like, man, these people who are on this Aquasphere, like, aren't replying to us? And that's, like, weird, because normally they're, like, banging down the door to leave.
They're so lonely! Stuck. Where's the lonely weirdos?
But, like, it's okay that they're not opening the door for us, because our replacement crew knows how to open the door. So we're just gonna open the door. And they're like, okay, go ahead. Open the door. It's fine. This is such a long sequence about opening a damn door. And so they do.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations. They do open the door.
They open the door, and there's no one there. So they're like, we're going to go in and kind of look around. This is weird.
And the rest of the opening act, the rest of the cold open sequence, is all inside the bridge of the Sequest, with Bridger and
Hitchcock
and O'Neill listening to Ford and his uniformed grunts. And we just hear all this ominous chatter. There's apparently a smell that that one of the relief crew finds remarkable and, in the background.
This is really weird. Things are... What's that? Oh, man, this place is torn up. What happened here? Oh, my God. Oh, and everyone calm down.
As we're still locked on the faces of our bridge crew on Sequest, looking at each other, as they get the message from Ford crackling over the radio, there are no survivors.
Yeah.
They found all six bodies. And so this super ominous thing, dun, 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 then goes into the very cheerful, optimistic opening theme.
And when we come back, it is Bridger and Westphalen walking down a hallway. He's like, so what do we know? And she's like, what do we know? We got six bodies, 3 male, 3 female. They're all dead.
But she reassures him that you can learn a lot from dead bodies once she does the autopsies. She does autopsies, too.
She does everything.
She can juggle. She studied at Le Cordon Bleu. She can do anything.
She is the predecessor to Agent Scully.
There are some things Agent Scully could not do.
Very few.
She couldn't keep a man.
Rude. That's so mean.
That's such a big part of, like, the first 3 seasons. Her friends that we never meet keep putting her on blind dates.
True. But rude.
And hey, not predecessor. These shows premiered in the very same week.
Okay, fine.
They're parallel. They're hand in hand. The sisterhood of multi-talented women.
This was the for some reason, Sequest just seems before. Seems before the time. I guess this is the era of, like, if we're gonna have a medical someone, they mm-hmm. can do everything. Yeah. They know how to do it. She's like, yeah, we'll find out. Dead bodies can talk. It's okay. Ford and the rest of the people who were going to be boarding,
mm-hmm.
which includes, like, one other Sequest officer and then a whole big group of scientists, including this guy who's, like, I guess, like, the head of the party,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Dr. Levin.
And they are all in quarantine, but it starts with just seeing Ford in the window, and he is very, very testy. He does not want Krieg to bring him crossword puzzles. No, thank you.
Or regular puzzles. No puzzles.
No puzzles.
No fun.
No.
Ford does not have fun. If you want to bring him socks to sort, he will have fun, but mm-hmm, no puzzles.
Mm-hmm, no.
You're
describing Boober Fraggle, actually. That's a different guy.
That is Ford. That is... who is the rest of the Fraggles? If that... Okay. Krieg...
Uh-huh.
Krieg is Wembley.
All right. Mm-hmm. You know what? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Krieg is
mm-hmm.
Wembley.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Bridger... Is Bridger Uncle Traveling yep. Matt?
Bridger is Uncle Traveling Matt, clearly. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Red... Who's Red?
I think... I think Hitchcock, because she's always in the gym.
I was going to go with it's Hitchcock, because she likes adventure, and she is in the gym, and she will go shoot things.
When has she shot things?
She?
When did Red Fraggle shoot things?
It just seems like a thing that they both do. Okay. Who's Moki?
Darwin.
Darwin's Moki?
Or is Darwin's Gobo?
Darwin's Gobo.
Yes.
So who's Moki then?
Crocker.
No. Well, Crocker, we do learn, like, follows a lot of weird shit.
Crocker is the architect doozer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is Lucas Sprocket?
Yes.
This all makes so much sense. I feel like we got to redo this for every season. Though,
sure,
when we get
sure.
new crew members and we lose some. But yeah, Lucas is the constant. Lucas is Sprocket. Always there.
So are all the other Fraggles.
I know. But here's the thing. Is Lucas is the bridge. He's the bridge
that's
between
true.
The worlds.
That's true.
The young and the old. The computers and the people.
He's
the bridge. He's the Sprocket.
He's barking at the hole in the wall. And the hole in the wall is the internet.
Yes.
Yes.
He's got dogs. There's watchdogs. <coming in. laughs> What?
And who gets all of Uncle Traveling Matt's postcards? Sprocket does.
Yeah.
I mean, Gobo eventually, but they go through Sprocket.
They go through Sprocket. His true son. Yeah, it makes sense.
I love you, dear.
I love you, too. It's this is great. I love this. So, after Krieg gets yelled at by Ford to, like, get the fuck out of there, Wes Phelan and Bridger come up to the window. Now, this isolation thing is, like, the same set piece that was
The hyperbaric chamber.
Yes.
That got the bubbles out of that kid's toes.
Yes, it is the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's multi-use. And what we learn later on is that it has apparently back rooms. Because there's like 15 people. Because
it's just Ford. It's just Ford. But then in
it's
this
Ford
sequence.
And like Levin. Yeah. And then suddenly there's just a bajillion other people.
The camera moves. And so we're looking in the window on the other side of the double door. And oh yeah, Levin was here too the whole time. Just hidden behind the non-window part of the door.
Yes.
And eventually, yeah, the entire crew complement will just suddenly be there.
They're just there. And you're like, where the fuck were you? Which I guess, like, this makes sense that there's back rooms. You need a bathroom for these people.
They were all in the bathroom? There were six people in the bathroom?
It's like our old apartment where the bathroom was like a whole nother bedroom. It was gigantic compared to the ratio of the rest of the place. Ford is just very on edge. He's like, why are we being quarantined? Why are we doing this? Like, we shouldn't be like this. And, like, you didn't see the people there.
Open the door. The people want to shop.
And he, like, wants to take a crew back to the Liberté to, like, figure out what happened. And they're like, you're going to stay here till we figure out what the fuck's going on. Stay. Sit. which he doesn't
like.
No,
Lucas is the dog. We could, never mind. Never. We can't go back to this.
Levin is all like, oh, so Levin's like sitting in the back and Bridger's like, hey, what do you think? Do you think being quarantined is necessary? And he's like, well, if you asked me 5 minutes ago, I would have said no. But now I say yes.
Because when everyone else was loading corpses onto gurneys, Levin was just ruffling around the filing cabinet.
Yeah.
He's been reading text logs to figure out how all the scientists died. Levin is really into Resident Evil. Like, he's a gamer, clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This makes sense. And so he found out through this that they were trying to, or he was trying to identify a canister he saw. And so he was listening to these logs to try to do that. And what he found out is that there was a work log from 3 days ago where they went outside the sphere.
And they found something.
Something. Not from around here. It's not where it belongs.
Something itchy or tasty.
So, of course, you know what this means? It means we're taking the hyper-reality probe out.
Yeah,
we're gonna go out. We're gonna look.
And what they find looks like a gigantic glass bottle. This is the shape of the capsule they found. It is a cylinder that then tapers with a narrow cylinder neck sticking out one end.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a space platform that deorbited and crashed into the ocean and settled down near this ridge in the mid-Atlantic, which is remarkably, remarkably intact. If you thought an outbuilding for the Library of Alexandria somehow remaining watertight over millennia was a bit of a stretch. There's no heat shielding on this thing.
It totally made it down totally fine. Nice and sealed, nice and safe.
It didn't crack. It didn't, like, the Titanic, famously discovered by SeaQuest DSV consultant Bob Ballard,
mm-hmm.
is spread out over miles. And it didn't come down from space.
No. But this one, this is good. It's built well.
They don't make them like they used to will have.
And so they find out that this is the Liberté.
The Liberté, yes.
The Liberté crashed on October 19th, 2009. Happy anniversary.
Why didn't they call it the 24th? That would have been the air date.
Disappointing.
Crocker remembers it as Game 7 of the 2009 World Series. He was watching Seattle play Havana. Wild, wild idea of the near future that Cuba would join, that a Cuban team would join Major League Baseball.
Yeah, dang.
For one thing, that's earlier than the 2009 World Series even began, let alone ended. I guess baseball has like 10 games less per season in the future to move things up.
As global warming's happened, the seasons have shifted, and they acknowledge this, and they started baseball season earlier.
This makes sense. This makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And it's not like they didn't predict expansion teams. Havana came from somewhere. whatever. For the curious, the Yankees won the World Series that year in November.
Oh.
When the World Series tends to end.
Yeah. So they decide to open the hatch mm-hmm. with the probe, and they do. And hey, guess what? There's like a dead body in there.
Several.
There's several dead bodies in there floating around.
Fully intact.
In their spacesuits.
Watertight seals at the bottom of the ocean.
So, yeah, they take a little look around. And then we're back over in C-Deck by all the isolation thing. And Lucas comes, like, leaping through the holes.
The holes?
The door holes. Porthole? No, not porthole. What would you call it?
The walkway.
It's not just a hall. It's the, like, ones you gotta, like, step. So he has to, like, jump through. Like it's a Sonic ring.
He is really doing a lot. Jonathan Brandis is, I would say, really overdoing it with all of his little gestures and motions and, like, flourishes when he pushes buttons.
It's, like, very... This episode...
He's over-egging it this time.
I'm very interested to know when this one was filmed because it's very different than how he is portrayed
mm-hmm.
in, like, any other episode this season.
It's like he was directed to be impish, and he just went too far.
Lucas ate a lot of candy before.
It's like a little extra 10% on all of his movements, and I don't like it.
He's been snooping around on the computers like he, you know.
It's what they keep him for.
Keep him around for.
If he doesn't get 10 hacks done a day, they don't feed him.
And so he has found out that the Liberté belonged to, you know, the North Seas Confederation, and confirmed the dates of it. And he's like, that's PL. And they're like, what the fuck does that mean? And he's like, pre-Lucas.
Yes.
Before my parents fucked.
The one time ever.
Probably. They don't seem to like each other
they
much.
They finished with a firm handshake.
Things.
Hands. Yeah. So I guess that means it went to space before December 2002. That's Lucas's birthday, December 23rd, 2002. Mark your calendars.
Yeah. He's like, well, here's the thing. They're hiding something because, like, everything was too clean. So then found the autonomous zone of internet files.
Yeah, a dumping ground for corporate raiders, and that's where you find the real dirt that's been scrubbed in cover-ups, apparently.
And so all the stuff says, you know, there was a 4-man crew, and they all got pulled before the crash.
When in reality, only one person was pulled from the station before it crashed. That's something we have, like, Sandra Bullock do. That's movie stuff.
Yeah. And so the one guy that survived is...
Well, Lucas calls him Guy Peachy.
Yes.
Or Guy Petch, I think.
I don't even...
Because Lucas does not know French. This man is Guy Peche.
Here's the thing. He does know French. He knows French. In a few episodes, he will speak French.
This is what inspires him to learn French. Because right now, he thinks Guy Peche is pronounced Guy Petch.
He speaks perfect fucking fluent French later.
That's what happens when you hang out with O'Neill.
Ugh.
Just being O'Neill's friend is an immersion language course in 6 languages.
Yeah.
But he gets that correction from Bridger, who is a personal acquaintance of Dr. Peche.
Yes, he's met him once.
They met at a conference.
He's a big fan of his.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He's a genetic physicist. Really inspired Bridger in some of his work and whatnot. And through all this, Ford's been listening and just starts, like, going off about
he's
everything.
He's so angry!
And so Lucas just puts him on mute, because there's a mute button.
Again, with a little, like, extra flick of the wrist when he pushes the button. Like, what are you doing?
Okay,
what is this? Who is this
that,
for?
That actually is the one thing I feel like is absolutely true to character. It's him being like, no, we're not doing this. But he is quickly given a look by Bridger and must unmute him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Wes Phelan has found out that it is definitely a virus that mm-hmm. attacks the nervous system, and it is fatal, but like, eh?
Can we get them to chew the special seaweed that Darwin's mom brought us? Will that do anything?
Bridger's very like, well, you know, so they all have it? Like, you got a plan to attack this, right? And she's like, I don't even know what it is! Like, how do I have a plan? And so they have a little moment there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Levin.
Yes.
Is doing all right in there, honestly, and is giving a lot of orders to other scientists outside, because he is, like, also very much trying to help solve this mystery of what the fuck's going on.
We have to talk about Levin and particularly his facial hair situation.
Yeah.
Dr. Levin is a riverboat gambler. Dr. Levin has the beard of the devil. But, like, the fun devil. Like,
like, I want to be his friend.
Like
devil.
Like if the Campbell soup can had the devil on it. That beard.
The devil with the friendly eyes. That will be like, hey kid, you want to learn to play this guitar really well.
Dr. Levin has the facial hair of a Civil War reenactor and not for the Union.
Yes. This is true, actually. This is very true. He has just like the beard of a 1800s farmer.
An 1800s farm owner, but we all know who's still in those fields.
Yeah. Do we want to address the fact that he sticks around?
Well, he has to stick around to sell me his delicious fried chicken.
Wes Phelan's letting them know, like, hey, you're sticking in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get, none of you get to leave at this point. which this is when we see, like, 25 bajillion people suddenly behind them that we did not know were there.
Uh-huh.
Like, where the fuck did you come from?
They're reproducing in there, I swear.
And everyone is doing much better than Ford. This is one thing I do not understand about this episode is why Ford is like on a mental breakdown, like,
yeah,
for a while now, and everyone else seems totally okay.
There are past infections, like, say, in Aquasphere 7 of this disease. And whenever we hear the story about this, it sounds like people tore each other apart as their bodies were failing. In this case, it's just Ford?
Yes. Like, Ford is the only one that seems to be losing it.
They showed no sign of anyone else having symptoms.
No. And so, with this news that they must stay in isolation, though, the one other, like, Sequest crew member that's in there does kind of break down and is like, can I, like, call my wife?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Bridger says, yeah, you can all call your families, which is the nice Bridger thing to do, but part of me's like, y'all don't know what you're fucking dealing with. Do you want this leaked off the boat?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Especially with some sort of deep, dark secret buried by one of the UEO member coalitions.
Yeah, it seems a little, like, not up to code.
O'Neill is there in the relay room.
It's like muting people. He's, quack, yes, quack, yes. Quack.
He's like the guy on the 3-second delay who has to, like, bleep people on SNL.
And so Bridger gives everyone a pep talk, too.
That's why the big group is there for the big speech.
About how, like, we're gonna figure this out. We're gonna get through this. Like, I'm not gonna give up on you.
You're here because of your excellence.
Yeah. So then Bridger, though, leaves to go pack because he's gonna leave to go try to find the dude.
Guy Pichet?
Pichet, yes. I was, like, totally blanking out his name all of a sudden.
Guy Petch?
Yeah, Guy Petch. And so our good buddy Guy, Lucas has tracked down his address. And going along with our Sprocket conversation, they dogged his leak.
Yeah.
His link. They tracked him. They definitely know where they are in the ocean right now.
He is sharing his plans with West Phalen and meeting with Lucas in a long walk and talk through the hallways, which is our one and only Darwin scene of the episode.
Yes!
Darwin is swimming around in a Darwin tube in the background, and then they turn the corner.
That's all we get. He doesn't even get a line. That's so mean. And so, yeah, he's gonna go track down this dude. West Phalen's giving him all these, like, questions to ask, and he's like, well, I don't need those. I'm gonna, like, bring him back here and you can ask him the questions. And Hitchcock also meets up with him, and he's like, hey,
he's got orders. Ford is in charge when Bridger's away, but Bridger's also like, hey, you got two big jobs. Number one, you need to be on the bridge working with Ford so he can make decisions. Number two, if he makes a bad decision, you've got to be in charge.
Yeah. You have my permission to remove him from command.
Yeah. Yeah. If he is at all impaired. Because so far, like, okay, we are television viewers. We know that this is a symptom that's going to get worse. But so far, he could just be really frustrated at the situation.
He could have claustrophobia.
You know?
That could be it, honestly. It's just he doesn't like sharing the bathroom.
Again, that's not it. We know it's not. We're savvy viewers. But in the reality of the fiction, he could just be kind of cranky.
We go back to West Phalen chatting with Ford.
Who is so sweaty.
He's so sweaty. His, like, hand is locked in a fist. And, like, West Phalen's like, hey, open your hand for me. And he, like, can't.
It takes, like, 5 seconds and he still doesn't get full extension. Yeah.
And he's snapping at her left and right and just, like, begging her to understand that she didn't see what it was like. She didn't see the scratches and the bruises that they, like, all inflicted on themselves and each other. And that's what's gonna happen. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't understand.
Sweaty looks so good on TV. They're reflecting all the lights from every direction. Yeah.
Let me tell you, I didn't look like that this weekend. I didn't look that good. I just looked gross.
Well, you just had the sun.
Just the sun and some, like, fluorescent lights.
Yeah.
Doesn't really work the same way.
I think that's the reason that on TV, when you're sick, you get really sweaty no matter what kind of sick you are.
Yeah.
Just because it looks better.
Looks better. So while all this is happening,
mm-hmm.
Another sub is coming into the area.
Yeah, this is like a flat wide sub.
It is.
It is.
It is. It's weird. It's a weird sub.
This is obviously a creation because there are no submarines in the world that look like this boat.
No. No, it's really not dynamic for water.
But it is an attack craft from the North Sea Coalition.
Confederation.
That's the one.
And they have come to get their space station. They want the Liberté.
Mm-hmm. which O'Neill knows because he does speak fluent French. Thank you very much.
So does Lucas. They just don't realize this yet. Maybe Lucas just doesn't want them to know at this point that he speaks. He doesn't want to be that much of a nerd that he knows all. Yeah. Like, no, I don't speak another language. And then later they find out he speaks like five.
He's looking at Westphal and is like, that lady never gets any sleep. I gotta hide some of my skills.
Yeah.
I gotta fly under the radar here.
So Bridger and Crocker go to France and get out of a tiny ass little car.
They are in Montbard, France. Yes. Home to Guy Pichet and the Abbey of Fontenay, a UNESCO World Heritage Site that is over 900 years old.
Oh, dang.
Yes.
Dang. Well, that's not where they go.
No.
They just go to his apartment to see if he's home, and he's not. And while Bridger's up there, like, knocking on the door, Crocker decides to try to speak French to a woman who's walking by, which gets him slapped in the fucking face and yelled at.
Crocker doesn't speak with a lot of women.
And does not speak French well at all. And when Bridger comes down and he's like, hey, what was that? He's like, I was just trying to get directions. She didn't know which way to go. It's fine.
Voulez-vous rumpy pumpy? Enchanté?
What do you need directions for? You are at the address.
He was asking for directions to the nearest bit of Viol Salty Blue, the only place where Crocker really belongs in this world.
They decide to wait because that's all they can do. They don't know where else this dude would be.
So they just sit down on this guy's front steps and just, like, chill.
And I would like to point out,
I kind of wish Crocker was, like, shooting dice.
That if you ever need a present for me, you can figure out how to get me a Sequest bomber jacket. Because that is all I want. I want one of those jackets with the giant-ass UEO patch on the back. They're so good.
I love, it's not in this scene, it's later, but I want to talk about it now, the futuristic car they have.
Oh, yes.
This long, narrow, very European, frankly, looking car with one giant windshield wiper.
Yes. Yes.
That is permanently up because there's nowhere to fold it away. It's too big.
It's too big. Too big. I'm scared. So back on the Sequest, Hitchcock is talking to Ford and filling him in on the fact that there's this other sub and she doesn't like their attitude and they want the Liberté. And he's like, well, what's the captain say? And she's like, well, remember, he's not here. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So blast him out of the water. Is that a problem?
And she's like, yeah, actually it is. They're UEO. They also, like, kind of own the Liberté.
All right, then give it to him and let's leave. What?
That's also kind of a problem. And he's like, well, I gave you an order. She's like, you gave me two. Well, what does the captain say? I will go ask him. I'm just going to go ask him. So, it's fine. We're just going to put a pin in this conversation.
So Commander Ford, first officer of the Sequest, has been in command for about 9 minutes before being deemed unfit.
Hey, it was more because Bridger got to France. So on the bridge, Hitchcock. Oh,
but this scene ends.
Oh, yeah.
This scene ends with Ford looking down at his hands, his clutched fist, and he opens it judderingly. And he gave himself the old Betty Cooper. His palms are bleeding from the impression of his fingernails.
Which is impressive because most men keep their nails very short.
Well, he's really gripping.
There are times where I've, like, been like, man, like, when we were watching that, I'd be like, oh, how do you do that? I was like, I cannot grip my hand enough to do that.
You gotta sharpen them. That's what the nail file's for.
I
mean, that's the thing.
I was like, I would have to, like, grow them out for that to be it. Like, I cannot grip my hand enough.
So that is the commercial break cliffhanger that brings us into, yes, Hitchcock in command. Her ex told her she was destined for this moment.
And so she lets everyone know that Ford is relieved from command.
Mm-hmm.
And then she radios that sub and she's like, back the fuck off. And they're like, what are you gonna do about it? We got torpedoes. And she's like, yeah, so do I. Don't touch it. And they're like, okay, fine.
She intimidates them into closing their tubes.
Yes.
Which, if she were a mother, is how she'd keep her kids from getting teen pregnant.
Intimidating them to close their tubes?
Yeah.
You know, it'd be cool if you could just, like, do that. Like, it'd be like, yes, I've closed them.
It's prom just night, and think. She says, now you listen here, young lady. And then just, nope.
Well, I'm just thinking if there was, like, a way to, like, think my, and close. And they're just closed.
Yeah.
Why have we not evolved to that? That would be amazing. And just like, nope.
No.
You just have to like wink or something.
This
like,
is what Dune's about.
Wink on the left, this wink the, on the right. This we're is good. The
Betty Jesseret way.
Double wink. That really puts a new perspective on Bert's whole thing in Mary Poppins.
You're describing Prana Bindu training. This is Ollie Dune.
That's all I want. So back in France.
Back in France.
Dr. Pichet shows up.
Dr. Guy Pichet here is played by legendary guest star Udo Kier, a man who will be in anything that makes someone say, wait, Udo Kier was in that? This is right in his transition period between doing almost exclusively German language film to almost exclusively English language work. The following year, you will see him in Ace Ventura Pet Detective.
Is there anything he's been in that I've seen?
I know you watched Melancholia. He's in that. There's a second Earth and it's crashing into Kirsten Dunst.
Yeah. I like that movie. That movie was weird.
He's in that movie.
That was a fun movie. That was a good movie. No, I'll let you pass with, I guess, one.
Along with many other Lars von Trier films.
Okay. So he comes on up and he's like, yo, dude, get out of my stoop. I want to go up to my apartment. And Crocker's
and they're like, hey, are you Guy Pichet? And he's like, no, I just live in his apartment. Get out of my way.
I don't know who that is.
My name's Guy Petch. I'm a different guy.
Guy Peach.
I'm Man Fruit. Wait, Man Fruit. I shouldn't say that to a lonely Navy man. He might get the wrong idea.
So they follow him up to his apartment while he's like protesting who he is the whole time. And Bridger's like, no, I know you. You know me. We were at a futurist conference together.
And then he picks up a framed photo on his coffee table, a selfie with him in a spacesuit and another guy in a spacesuit in a space capsule giving a thumbs up from their super secret, hushed up cover up mission.
Were they doing thumbs up? I thought they were doing shots. I thought they were toasting, like going cheers with their little shots, and then they were like, nope. I did not notice the thumbs up. I've never noticed thumbs up. I thought they were holding little cups.
You just know the test pilots at Area 51 have got framed selfies of them at Area 51.
I would. Obviously. Like, if you're there, you're not gonna not. Now, the one thing that they never predicted in this show is, like, social media.
Or accurate baseball, ever.
Well, no. But I just think some of these stories, I think of, like, all these people would have been so screwed if, like, Instagram existed. Yeah. That would be everywhere.
So, Lucas would be finding Guy Pichet through his Facebook statuses.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, there's this long gap, but then he reappeared shortly after the crash.
And I can see from that he checked in at the McDonald's in
Central France, I
guess. Central France on this day, so he must still be in the area.
There's something about a guy named Pierre. Apparently it's complicated.
They're like, we need your help. Mm-hmm, it's about the Liberté. Here's the deal. We found it.
Mm-hmm.
It exists. And he's like, no, I need to write. I need to write my book right now. You guys all need to leave.
If you got really questions about my career, it'll be in the book. I haven't written it yet. Please leave.
And he's like, no, people are dying.
And he responds, that's what people do. They die. The only things that survive are pain and guilt, he says in his very heavy French accent.
He's very emo.
But at least he's given up the ghost of pretending he's not who he is and pretending that he doesn't know anything about the Liberté, the capsule on which he did a lot of science.
Yes.
And Bridger asked him a question that threw me for a loop. Mm-hmm. What was it like up there on the moon?
He didn't specifically say the moon.
He definitely did. What was it like on the moon?
I thought he just said, what was it like up there while looking out the window? I don't think he said moon. You said moon. I don't remember him saying moon.
I think he was on the moon.
Maybe.
But of course, Dr. Gee talks about the world being like a blue marble. And Bridger says, ah, yes, it's the ocean is blue from below, too. Perhaps our worlds aren't so different.
And he's like, I'm offering you a chance to see mine. Will you take it? I was like, when did you offer him a chance? Like, we have missed some dialogue here. This is the first this man is hearing of a chance to see your world.
Just a string of inanities carried on the broad shoulders of both Roy Scheider and the score.
Yes.
This is when what I think about this episode really crystallized for me. As strong as the concept is, as much as I enjoy Udo Kier's weird hollow shell of a Dr. Pichet, the script is so cliche-ridden and just uninspired.
It's one, too, where I feel like there's more script than what we see.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they, like, cut stuff but then didn't, like, rewrite enough to make up for what they cut.
But so many of the lines we have are things I've heard 1,000 times.
That, too.
I don't want to hear about blue marbles.
That's why I told you that Brothers and Sisters was a better episode.
I didn't disagree, even before we started watching.
You kind of did. It took you a moment to agree with me. You were like,
it took me a moment to remember what I was in for, yes.
They convince him to go, and they're on a shuttle back to the Sequest. And of course, we're having the whole conversation of like, oh, yes, the ocean is like space. It's very dark and mysterious.
In this sequence, Pichet sounds like the nerdy girl with glasses, but like this dashing prince came to her small town and noticed her and is going to whisk her away.
Oh, maybe I shouldn't have come to the ball.
His eyes are opened up to a new way of seeing. And me? You would bring me to your underwater kingdom?
So he starts to eventually hear, explain what was going on up there. That they were put into space to conduct genetic research.
And horrible, horrible experiments.
And they were doing experiments that went wrong. There was an accident on board. People got contaminated. And he was in the safe room. So he was allowed to return. Once they got him off, all the safety procedures went into play, which was supposed to destroy it, but instead it just caused it to crash.
The French build their space capsules too strong. Unreasonably strong.
Not destroyable in any shape or form.
Impossibly strong.
So they get to the Sequest. Hitchcock fills Bridger in on what's going on. She gets told to take Dr. Dude to Westphalen and is like, okay. Some time goes by because mm-hmm. they've had enough time to get him a Sequest sweater vest. Didn't know we had that.
Sure. It's cold down there. It's wet. Everything's wet.
And Westphalen's there and Lucas is there and they're doing research.
Ford is wettest of them all.
With all the sweat.
And yeah. And Kier plays Pichet so feeble. Like this experience left him hollow.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
Yeah. And so he's, like, slowly trying to help them by remembering, like, what stuff was. Because it's mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. What chromosome were they working on? And he's like, I don't really remember. I don't really remember. Westphalen's trying to, like, pull information from him. And eventually they get that it was a new strain of meningitis.
Mm-hmm. That somehow has something to do with the human 21st chromosome, and he mentions four base pairs. Four base pairs codes for basically nothing. This is just a script writer came in and said, like, technobabble, fill in the blank, and then somebody passed by, like, what can I do with, like, four words? There you go. This is nothing. It means nothing.
And West Villain's like, how could you create a disease and not a cure? And it's like, well, that's what they do in every single sci-fi thing ever, is create a disease and not a cure. And then we got to find the cure. And it's a whole thing. He's trying to, like, refocus, though, with them. And he has, like, you know, the 21st chromosome. That's what it was. And she's like, are you sure? And he's like, no, I'm not. I'm not sure about anything.
It has to be the 21st human chromosome, because meningitis has one chromosome.
Oh.
So I don't understand.
So if we're saying meningitis, we should just, like, no.
Yeah.
We should be like, ah, yes, that's
it's
it.
It's the only chromosome you have to work with. So I don't understand how it's both. I don't get... It's bad science. It's just bad.
He realizes that it's bad because he's like, I can't do this. I can't do it. I've got to leave. And he like runs away. Meanwhile, our good buddy Krieg has gone into the isolation area with, you know, a protective suit on.
He's got his big sealed hazmat suit. He's hey, it's your big buddy Krieg. Everybody gather around. He's got Santa's bag full of distractions and treats.
And toys. And,
hey, Commander, strap this porn on your face.
It totally is porn. Because anytime Krieg's like, I'm going to get something from my personal collection, it's porn.
Testy, angry, like psychological symptomatic Ford says, no, get that VR headset off my face. And Krieg is like, what are you talking about? How would you insult my library? He's a curator is what he is. He's a connoisseur.
Yeah.
He has taste.
He has his archive. He preserves.
he has taste. He doesn't have smell. That also helps him with his situation.
Ford is not having this, and he grabs Krieg and is all like, leave me alone, and like rips Krieg's protective suit, which means Krieg is now part of the isolation containment group. He cannot leave.
He gets up, he runs. Captain Bridger happened to be walking by the window in the moment. He's like, Buster, you sit your butt down, you live here now. And he's like, oh yeah, I live here now.
Yeah. Wes Phelan fills Bridger in on the fact that he left. Shay left. And it's like, well, he seems more keen on drinking than thinking. And Bridger's like, fuck that! And goes down to him, where he's sitting in, like, the crew cafeteria with a giant bottle of booze. And just, like, swipes it from the table.
Quote, I didn't bring him this far for drinking. Just inane, inane lines.
And he's like, you're not quitting on my crew!
You can quit on yourself, but don't you dare quit on me. Again, 100% cliche from here on out.
But Roy Scheider, very good actor. Good selling it, dude.
He's doing better than anyone reasonably could.
Yes. This is when the truth starts to come out
about
why he's so broken up about everything, is that he wasn't the only survivor. There were two survivors.
Even the secret files hold secrets. You see, one of the crew members, Pierre, seemed to be naturally immune, and Guy watched Pierre die, be beaten to death by his infected crewmates, rather than breach containment and let him out to get evacuated as well. So it's a good thing his corpse is probably in that mysteriously intact capsule.
And guess what? It totally is! Which means, like, Wes Phelan's like, hey, I bet he's got a natural, he could be the natural antidote. We just need to get some DNA. And, you know, it's really cold ocean, so it should be fine. And so they're like, yeah, let's do that. And Bridger, like all captains in sci-fi shows, decides that he must be on the crew that goes. It's going to be him. It's going to be Crocker.
And Guy. It's the France friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're going to go over to the Liberté.
They're inviting that lady to come slap Crocker again, just to really bring the whole gang together. They're
going to go collect some bone marrow or whatever. And Hitchcock is going to deal with some very angry North Sea Confederation people that are hanging out.
The North Sea Confederation that seems to be entirely French.
Yes.
Everything we hear about is in French.
They are saying that they are going to destroy the Liberté. They're going to destroy what's theirs.
Mm-hmm, because
they're trying to cover what's there.
And it's not the submarine that they have to worry about anymore. It's the orbital missile platform.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. But Ortiz is like, you know, from that far away, they really can't tell the difference between us or the Liberté, which is a pro and a con.
Yeah, that's not a great look considering they're 20 times the size of the Liberté, at least.
So they're like, great, they won't be able to tell that we're taking a launch over. That'll be fine. So they go over.
Always finding a silver lining there, Cap.
And throughout these scenes, we go back and forth between the Liberté and the Sequest. And on the Sequest, still they're dealing with the fact that missiles are being launched at them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're sending countermeasures. They're sending decoys to draw things away. They're trying to scramble targeting.
Yeah.
Everything they can to keep missiles from striking or even disturbing the Liberté, as, you know, the seal to the launch isn't infallible.
Yeah, it's not great. Every time there's a boom outside, more water comes through. So they're at the Liberté. The water that was in there before is now gone, and so all the bodies are just laying pretty soggy on the floor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they're like, which one is Pierre? And instead of being like, oh, this one, because it says Pierre on his spacesuit, he's like, it's this one, because I recognize the watch his wife gave him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, fuck.
The watch that he pinned to the outside of his spacesuit,
yes.
like a military medal.
Yes.
Sure. All right.
Well, because you can't put it on your wrist that's inside the spacesuit.
Right.
You know what he needs? A watch window.
Yeah.
Big believer in watch windows.
They didn't have those in Space 2001. Not 2001, but you know what I mean.
A running clothes company I like actually just today had an ad that I felt like was made for me because it said it was watch window season. And it was a close-up of like the little watch window on the shirt. And
yeah.
I was like, yes.
Yeah.
This is the company that made watch window gloves.
Ooh.
I have those.
Okay.
I love it.
So after they find dear departed poor little Pierre.
Yes.
Crocker, in a moment of dark comedy, turns to Bridger and says, you want to carve? As he holds up these tiny little tweezers to get a bone marrow sample.
Yeah.
Bone marrow is big syringe, not tiny tweezers.
Yeah. Yeah. Why did you send Crocker to do this job? Crocker doesn't know. Crocker thinks...
You think Crocker picked the toolkit, too?
He knows that you're supposed to be able to eat marrow out of a bone at a restaurant.
Sure,
and
sure.
And so he's like, ah, oh, they must use a straw. The tweezers are the closest thing I have.
I don't want to get a milkshake from Crocker. He puts forceps in there. I asked why forceps, and he said, oh, because it's thick.
They get what they need, and while they're doing that, they also find a canister, and they're like, hey, what's this? And the guy's like, that's the canister of death! Which would totally be our episode name if we were doing it that way.
Yeah.
And so they put it in a tote bag. It's like a little duffel bag, and they're like, yeah, let's just put this in there and we'll take it back
for
later.
It's like a bag for carrying your own bowling ball.
Yeah, your gym clothes.
And so Crocker goes back on the launch. Again, explosions in the distance are rocking the seal. Any moment they could be crushed like those billionaires going to see the Titanic.
Yes.
And Guy Pichet stops. He doesn't come because now he's going to make it right. He's going to go down with the ship the way he should have all those years ago, rather than watch his friend Pierre be beaten to death by disease, a maddened Frenchman.
So you know what Bridger does? Bridger punches him in the face and drags him on board the ship.
He starts by like trying to reason with him, trying to plead, but his heart's not in it. There's this real sense of now I got to deal with this bullshit. And he knows he's going to just knock him out.
Yeah.
He has to go through the motions for a second.
So you can be like, no, I tried. You can't like court martial me. I tried.
It's probably the best moment of the episode. Just him like, all right, here we go.
Like, no, punch. So back on the bridge of the Sequest, Hitchcock is trying to deal with the fact that a third missile's on the way, and she orders Ortiz to intercept it, but it's too late.
They're going to shoot this missile from space with their torpedoes.
Yes. And they haven't heard that, like, you know, they're off the Liberté or anything, so they're like, this is life or death. Bridger and Crocker, they're going to die. And, like, oh my god, we got, like, 20 seconds, and then all of a sudden, Bridger runs on board with Crocker onto the bridge and is like, go ahead, blow it up, let them. Like, if they want to destroy it, it's fine. And I'm like, you didn't think to fucking radio? Right?
Like, I see the dramatic choice of having them be in the room at the nick of time to say, belay that order. Here's, yeah, we saved the day already. But, like, you could have called. You could have called from the launch. That would be procedure to call from the launch.
There are so many times in this show that they will clearly state, we are having communication issues, which is why we can't communicate right now, and why this thing that shouldn't be a big deal is now a big deal. They didn't tell me they can't communicate, so, like, from everything I know, they can. Why the fuck did we not?
Yeah, why couldn't he do the dramatic interruption over the radio?
Like, we're out
from the launch.
We're out, Katie. Like, we're out, Hitchcock. We're out. Like, go ahead, launch it, launch it, or whatever. You know, let it blow him up. We're safe. No,
no,
no. The thing with this is they're like, well, sir, like, are you sure? Like, what if it scatters the virus? And he's like, well, I could only do that if there was something there to scatter. And they hold up the damn tote bag.
This is not an airtight seal. You need to get that in some plastic.
It is the canister of death.
It's not the canister of a bad day. It's not the canister of food poisoning. That's bad enough.
What?
This is the canister of death.
What? We just walked down hallways. We were on the Magnum. We came through the bridge with the canister of death in a bag.
I keep my lunch to go to work in a more secure container than the canister of death.
So, down in the sea deck, Wes Phelan's there, Lucas is there, they're doing science-y stuff, and he's like, hey!
The remainder of my notes through the rest of the episode are just three quotes that were so stupid and meaningless, I had to write them down. The first is Wes Phelan saying, damn genetic doctors cross the line from healing to killing. What does that mean? What are you talking about? What does that mean? Is this a problem that happens a lot in your future?
So they're getting a readout. It's working. Like,
oh, you mean when Lucas says, quote, that astronaut cell kicked some major chromosomal butt?
Yeah, that's so dumb.
It's so bad.
Lucas would never say that.
Major chromosomal butt.
It's so bad.
Is the problem the alteration to a human chromosome or to the meningitis? What is it?
I don't know.
No one knows.
No one knows. And so Wes Phelan is all like, we should tell them that they're not going to die. It's like, yeah, you should. Why don't you go tell them? You should tell them right away. Especially Ford. Is Ford okay?
Ford has beaten two scientists to death.
And so within the isolation chamber, Krieg and Ford are sitting next to each other. And Hitchcock is suddenly in there.
Yeah, Hitchcock is like putting cool compresses on Ford's sweaty, sweaty face.
And Krieg is just like, I never knew you had a Florence Nightingale thing in you. Like, what? What? Also, why would you allow another person to go in there after what happened?
Yeah, yeah. You gotta talk to the people who aren't showing symptoms and walk them through it, because I would not trust Ford at the moment with someone else's safety.
No!
Until they get the news 2 seconds later, like, yes, we have an effective treatment, you're all gonna be okay.
So, Bridger and Guy are, like, in the cafeteria. Having a little chat. Enjoying a drink.
And Captain Bridger asks him how he's enjoying the ocean, and he says, quote, the water, it has a very cleansing effect. Fuck off! That sucks! That's why we wash things in it, Gee. Yeah, man, you really had something. Oh, yeah, you did it.
It's so unfortunate this episode is in such a streak of good episodes.
Okay.
It's at least entertaining, unlike an episode a few from now that's just boring ass shit. And I say this, and I am like the super fan of this show. I love this show. There are episodes I do not like, that I hate, that I skip in my rewatches.
But like this one, the concept of an illness that will progress along a course that is unknown, except for the parts where it gets very, very bad. That's scary. That's tension. Mm-hmm. That's cool. A crew member therefore having to stand up and take charge in a way that they've always wanted but don't feel prepared for. Ooh, that's drama. That's tension. Mm-hmm. The journey of Dr. Guy Pichet and his guilt that ate him out, so he's a shadow of a man. It just doesn't come together because they say stupid things. They say such stupid things.
Yeah, we're just going for, like, the Oscar-winning line throughout the whole thing. And it's just don't do like, that.
Yeah, if you changed the score, you could make any of these lines look like the 30 Rock parody of Sequest, right? Yeah. Like, just change the focus a little bit. It's aiming for profound and just landing in inane every time.
Yeah. So then we get a Bob fact.
Bob facts!
And the Bob fact is like, hey, the Sequest has whiskers.
And he mentions the acronym Wireless Sea Knowledge Retrieval Satellites, and that they are based on an autonomous submarine currently in testing for months-long journeys under the sea. Ooh, isn't that cool?
That's it.
That's it. That's the Bob fact. That is pretty cool. That's a pretty cool fact.
That's cool. I'm kind of like, so what happened to it?
I need
to know what happened.
Can you name?
Yeah, he doesn't name it. So that makes it very hard to go look it up
now, 30 years later.
So what's your Bob fact?
I wanted to talk about the actual 21st chromosome.
Mm.
This chromosome is famous, perhaps infamous, because if you have three of it, that is the cause of Down syndrome. The 21st chromosome is that chromosome.
Mm-hmm.
There are between 212 and 256 protein-coding genes on the 21st chromosome, even though it is the smallest in the human genome.
Oh.
These are some facts that you now know about the 21st chromosome.
You want to know what my Bob fact is?
I would love to know your Bob fact.
The Spacecraft Cemetery.
Okay. All right.
This is known formally as the South Pacific Ocean Uninhabited Area.
Ooh.
It is a region in the Southern Pacific Ocean, east of New Zealand, where spacecraft that have reached the end of their usefulness have been purposely crash-landed in this area because it is roughly centered on the Point Nemo, which is like the pole of inaccessibility in the ocean.
Okay.
It's the location farthest from any land.
Which is where you would want to put your capsule of death.
Your capsule of death, it would be a perfect place. So,
but they missed. They got the wrong ocean.
They got the wrong spot. Should have gone to the spacecraft cemetery because, like, no one's going to go there. It's like 1,500 miles to the closest island or something.
So it's really east of New Zealand.
It's like really out there. And the reason they've picked a spot like that is because of, you know, the risk of environmentally hurting things or people. It is also an area that there's not like shipping really happening through because it's so fucking far from everything. So it's a safer place to have things. Now, the spacecraft cemetery region contains between 250 to 300 various spacecrafts.
Okay.
And it has been used by multiple international organizations. It is actually the location that when the International Space Station eventually comes down that they are planning to send it. Which is like what, 5 years or something in the future. It's not that far away. Yeah, there's a spacecraft cemetery.
Ooh.
So you could call those shipwrecks.
You could. They are space shipwrecks. Yeah. Yeah.
Could have some ghost stories about that.
Let's send Bob there.
Have a canister of death.
Hey, Bob, go look at those.
Go look at those. It'd be cool. Probably wrapping up there.
Sure, sure. Thank you all for joining us on yet another episode of Whiskers. We share knowledge regarding SeaQuest.
You should totally leave us a rating and review or subscribe wherever you listen to us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I have no new 5-star reviews on Apple Podcast Treat. At least not on the U.S. store. You know, I haven't checked the international ones. There might be a few hiding there. I'll look into that for next time.
Yeah, come on, people. Let's go.
But yes, we do love them. I eat them up, yum, 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 for my supper time. And you want me to starve? Do you? Do you?
Apparently. You're making him sad.
That's what it seems like. So
so do that.
We do appreciate that. You should also tell a friend. Word of mouth is how we grow our show. Our show that, I gotta say, the world's a little bit against us. There is no great big wave of SeaQuest fandom to ride the crest of, unfortunately.
No.
Except that which we make ourselves. And so we are deputizing each and every one of you.
Go tell your friends so I don't have to keep, like, go randomly stalking people on Twitter who are talking about SeaQuest and being like, hey, you should listen to my podcast.
Hey.
While you're at it, you should also listen to my other podcast, Throwback Bound, about Spellbinder. I am also awkwardly stalking people on social media who mention Spellbinder.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So far, I'm only desperate enough to contact the people who've mentioned in the past year. Haven't gone past that yet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So with that, I'm Elena.
I'm Grant, and in the words of Captain Nathan Bridger,
for beneath the surface lies the future.